Hello and welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and today I'm joined by Doug Wagner, the CEO and Chairman of Echo Global Logistics. Now, Doug's been in the industry for over 40 years, and he's seen it all, from LTL to truckload, from software to brokerage. We talk about changes he has seen over the years, challenges with operating during the pandemic, and what the future of the industry might look like, as well as a bunch of other stuff in between. Following my conversation with Doug, I'll be joined by Dr. Enam Ayoub to discuss the truckload market update. So let's get started. Welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, Doug.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So you're doing this on your spring break. The dedication and devotion is incredible. So I appreciate that.
Well, it's a nice break from the kids.
Oh, there we go. So I'm an excuse to be away from your family. That's always good to hear. Let's dive in. You've been in the trucking industry a long time. I think you entered in around 1980, right around there. So you sat through the initial stages of deregulation, the chaos, recessions, and now a pandemic. Over the 40 years that you've been here, what do you think's changed and what has stayed the same? Is it a dramatically different industry, or are there things that have stayed constant?
Yeah, it's a great question. Some things have stayed constant, the way freight moves, truck drivers, equipment, terminals, a lot of that is pretty similar to, you know, when I was a management trainee back in 1980. I think what's obviously changed is the technology and some of the data science that's being applied to our industry. And I'll talk a moment about that. You know, I when I went to school, I studied economics and computer science. And of course, as a bright-eyed kid coming into the workforce, I was amazed at how little actual statistics were used in business. And of course, there was virtually no technology back in those days. I went to work in an LTL company, and we had a big mainframe computer, and every office had terminals that connected to it, but we used the system for creating freight bills and rating them and invoicing customers. That was really it. There was no email. None of the luxuries that we have today even existed. And it was ironically about the same time that the personal computers were coming out. Right. And I remember buying my first PC was an Apple IIe. It actually preceded the Mac.
That was a great one.
It was.
I used that in my undergrad.
I had a hard drive with 3 megabytes of storage on it. So
you were the man. You were the man with that much.
I was the man. And I think I paid $3,000.
So, Doug, I learned to code on cards.
Yep.
So did I. And BASIC. So, yeah, where you had to draw the diagonal marker on it with a rubber band. So if you dropped them, you could put them back together. But yes. Go ahead. So you're hitting 1980. Technology is just emerging. And you're in the LTL industry.
Yeah. So I just, my entry into the business world was one of kind of amazement that, we weren't as far along as I thought we would be from the university perspective. But I quickly forgot about school and dived into my job and my business. And I would say if you fast forward to today, it's a remarkable transformation that we've seen in this industry, from onboard computing, data science, real-time tracking and analytics. So it's an exciting place to be. And I think that the transportation industry is somewhat caught up to the rest of the world.
Yeah. What about relationship? I always hear people coming in that it's not as much of a relationship business anymore because technology is usurping that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it is a relationship business. It may not be as much of a relationship business as when I first came into the industry. People are people. And people like to do business with people that they trust and people that they like. And that's an important factor, and especially if you're in a type of business where you have repeat transactions. So, if I buy a copy machine one time and I don't need one for another 4 years, the relationship probably doesn't matter. But if I'm buying LTL or truckload and I'm doing it every single day of the week, the relationship actually comes into play. I would say, though, over the last couple of decades that the business world has cleaned up a little bit. It's more professional now. We don't have the two martini lunches anymore. And so maybe the relationship isn't as important as it once was.
No, that's interesting. I was talking with the guys at Walmart who I did a bid for back in the 90s, and they're the first company I saw where you could not buy them a drink, right? You couldn't do this. And so it seems like the relationship is still there, but as you said, it's more professional. It's more data-driven. It's no longer tickets or dinners or drinks as much.
Exactly. I agree.
Okay. So you started with LTL, but now at Echo, the majority of your revenue, 70%, if I have the numbers right, is coming from truckload. And LTL and truckload weren't that different in pre-1980, but they're dramatically different now. What's the big differences have you found working across those two different industries?
Well, I mean, there's lots of differences. I mean, just starting with the way that the freight physically moves, right? You know, truckload, you've got a full trailer going from point A to point B. But right. LTL, by definition, is the consolidation of smaller shipments that have to be cross-docked. And it takes a hub and spoke network of some sort to efficiently mm-hmm. move that freight so that the carriers can have full trucks. So, you know, that's one clear difference. I think the way that the freight is priced is different.
Right.
You know, obviously in truckload, we think about a cost per mile. In LTL, we have this antiquated, archaic NMFC classification system. And that everybody has been saying that they want to get rid of since I joined the industry in 1980, but we still have it. But I think, it's old habits die hard, and that's what people are used to. But I do think there's a pretty big movement to change that.
So it's funny, Doug. I have to teach that every spring semester. And it's amazing teaching these people, and they don't believe me, that there's this whole classification system and how ridiculous it is. And they say, really? But then you explain, you know, what do you think's the hurdle? Do you think we'll ever go to DIM, DIM standards?
Well, that's what obviously makes sense. And, you know, back in my days as a carrier, you know, we used to study it. And one of the challenges that a carrier has in switching to DIM-based pricing is that, you know, if you're my shipper and you're on the current class system and I want to switch you to a DIM system, I can turn the dials so that your total freight cost will come out, you know, net neutral. But it's almost impossible to have each individual shipment retain its previous cost. So what happens is some of your clients are going to pay more for freight and some of them are going to pay less. And even though your cost is the same, you now have upset customers that can't understand why their freight's changing. So then what that does is it causes you, the shipper, to try to cherry pick amongst your carriers. So where the density rating gives you a better deal, you'll go with that. And where classification rating gives you a better deal, you'll go with that. And that's not really fair to the carrier.
Do you think it's ever going to change, or is it? We'll talk about some other things later on about things that should change, but are just so ingrained.
I do think it's going to change.
Do you see it with better data?
I do. I think a lot of the LTL carriers have really embraced these dimensionalizers, and they've got the data now to understand what the cube of a shipment is. They've got the forklift scales and other means to get the weight, so they can very quickly, in a touchless way, calculate density. And if you think about the NMFC system, density and susceptibility to damage are the two big drivers of price. Right. So I see a lot of momentum amongst the carriers themselves to get this going. And they're working with people like Echo and other 3PLs mm-hmm. to embrace it and try to make it the new standard. And I think it'll take time, but it'll eventually happen.
Okay. So LTL is a weird segment, right? Because it's squeezed on both ends. Partial is going up heavier and truckload goes down with multi-stop or partial truckload kind of things. Do you think there is a future for LTL? Do you think it'll expand beyond, what is it, like $70 billion now with the e-commerce and all these other things? Or do you think it's going to be stuck in that niche?
Yeah, you know, with the omni-channel retail strategies, getting the warehouses closer to the customer, mm-hmm. you know, more e-commerce, I do think there's going to be a lot of LTL freight. LTL fits an important niche in that it's the shipments that are too big to be parcel and too small to be truckload.
Right.
And it has to be handled differently, right? It has to go through a cross-dock infrastructure so that it can be efficiently moved. And, you know, I just don't see it going away because, truckload carriers can't efficiently haul, pallets of freight. and it's too big for the automation of the parcel company. So I think it'll stick around. I think that the LTL carriers themselves will get more sophisticated so that they can handle heavier shipments. We see that with some carriers now. They start to understand their backhaul, where their network will benefit from freight regardless of the price. And they entice shippers to give them the heavier shipments. And that's an opportunity for them. I also think, you know, doing consolidation for big box retailers is a product that they could move into. And I just don't see it going away anytime soon. It may not grow as fast as the overall.
Okay. Do you see it moving to home delivery? Because I've had LTL deliveries at home and it was a disaster because I didn't have a load back. Do you think with all the e-commerce, like bigger things are getting delivered at home, whether it's a Peloton or a big sofa or something, do you see them moving to that or is that too specialized and white glovey?
Yeah, I don't see it home delivery moving to LTL carriers. A, the carriers themselves don't want to do it. You know, they have a very high cost network, high fixed costs. And the only way they can make money is to have density on their pickup and delivery routes. And so they can't afford to be going off into a bedroom community and making a delivery and helping somebody, you know, move the Peloton into their house.
Right.
And so I think there's a natural niche for the final mile companies, the white glove companies, to work with LTL carriers. To have a higher quality of service to that end consumer and also, you know, keep the LTL carrier out of that business.
Yeah. There's no national white glove service really out there, is there? It seems like it's such a regional business. I know that companies like Wayfair and those are trying to grow these things, but no one's found a good solution that I've seen.
Yeah. I think maybe it's going to take some industry consolidation or something because, as you say, there's no ubiquitous coverage. And, you know, for like large retailers that need ubiquitous coverage, they really have to piece together a solution with a lot of regional players.
All right. Let's pivot to Echo. You joined in 2005, took it public 4 years later, and your revenue was right around $250 million. And I just saw the 2020 financials and it's now $2.5 billion. So that's a pretty big growth, 10x in what, 10 years? What do you contribute that to? Is it the industry? Is it something special that Echo did? What do you think? Is it just you?
I love to take credit for it, but I guess in full disclosure, it's a very large and fragmented addressable market, right? You know, if you look at the Armstrong and Associates data, I think we're up to about $100 billion now of 3PL type freight. And it's growing at like three times GDP. So there's lots of freight out there and it's very fragmented. You know, we have 50,000 carriers in our database. We have 30,000 shippers. And, you know, there's a lot more of each than that. So I think if you come up with a good sales model and you can execute and you can figure out an efficient and productive workflow, it's fairly easy to, you know, grow your market share. And, you know, in truckload in particular, it takes scale and density. And, you know, even though we started the company in 2005, we really didn't start doing truckload until 2010. So I can tell you in the first few years, we really struggled as a truckload broker because we just couldn't be competitive with the big guys. And we kind of bootstrapped our way to what I would call the minimum level of density in the market to start to become competitive. And then when we bought Command in 2015, that kind of pushed us over the tipping point. Yeah, it's just a big market. And I think, you know, you've got to figure out a way to, now, of course, we did it the old fashioned way. We were profitable the whole way.
That is the old fashioned way. That's old school, Doug. What are you doing?
We had, when we started the company, it was literally started with a few hundred thousand dollars and we built, kind of a prototype technology and proved the business model. And the original business model was mostly managed transportation. And
really?
I came along. Yeah,
we started out. You started with managed. Wow.
Well, we have two founders that didn't know anything about transportation, but had kind of used a outsourcing approach in some other industries. And so, you know, I joined them in the first year and they bought my company and made me the CEO. And very quickly, because of my LTL background, we created LTL brokerage.
Okay.
And then we grew the company from when I joined, the revenue was about $35 million. We grew to about $260 million in 2009. And that was mostly LTL and managed transportation. And then really after we went public in 2009, we started building out the truckload brokerage. So back to your original question, I think it's just, you know, you got to have a plan, you got to execute, you got to, in this day and age, you've got to incorporate technology and do it smart.
So you obviously, it's a crowded field, has been for the last 10, 15 years. So you've got traditional brokers, right? The C.H. Robinsons, XPOs, and those guys. And then Armstrong calls digital freight brokers, right? He coined the phrase, I think, the DFBs, the Convoys, the Ubers, and those guys. How do you differentiate yourself from those two? And are they different, the digital freight brokers and traditional? How do you classify them?
I think the lines are pretty blurry. You know, we actually think of ourselves as a digital freight broker. When we did our IPO in 2009 and went out on the roadshow and talked to investors, I mean, our story was all about technology. We weren't really talking much about freight. Hmm. In fact, the original analysts that covered us were tech analysts. We pretty quickly got thrown into the transportation sector because, you know, the transportation analysts understood our business more. But our original pitch in 2009 was, we're a tech company that makes money in freight. And so, you know, I think in the most recent wave of excitement about, you know, DFM or DFB, there's a lot of venture capital that's coming in, investing money.
Yeah.
You know, technology's actually got easier to build in the last few years with cloud computing and a lot of the services that you can use right out of the box. And so, you know, I think also building in a green field is an advantage. But the advantage that we have is that, you know, we not only have technology, but we have size, density, scale, and we have relationships. And if you think about the people that we do business with, either shippers or carriers, they exist somewhere on a spectrum from the very, very sophisticated to the running their business on a whiteboard
level
of sophistication. And, you know, we think it's important to be able to do business with all parties on that spectrum. So, you know, we can have a fully automated API relationship with a shipper or carrier, or we can accept a paper bill of lading.
It's interesting. So you consider yourself a digital broker, because a lot of people view that as a negative right now, because it almost smells like, you know, free money being in there and then operating at a loss. And obviously you haven't been, you've been profitable since 2005, since you started. Do you see that more traditional brokers are becoming digital, or do you see the digital guys are becoming more traditional? I mean, the lines are blurring. Are they moving one camp to the other, or is it something in the middle?
It's a great question. I think that the traditional brokers are investing heavily in technology and algorithms. Yeah. And I think that the so-called, you know, digital freight marketplace startup brokers are investing in people.
Yeah.
And I think there will be a convergence in the middle. And anybody that's relevant, that has scale, that has a market share, is going to have the capabilities of, you know, managing relationships and managing data.
So you mentioned 50,000 carrier customers that Echo currently has and 30,000 shippers. So those two sides of the market are not going to consolidate, I see. But what about the brokers in the middle? Do you see that coming down to like an hourglass type industry where there's fewer on, say, platform players? Or do you see there's a lot of mom and pop brokers out there still?
Yeah.
Do you see them going away and getting brought together, or will there always be room for them?
Well, I think there will always be room for them because there are no barriers to entry.
Right.
So, you know, you and I could start a brokerage in my garage tomorrow and, could buy. Let's do it. Literally, we could get some off the shelf software and a phone system and start dialing for dollars and dialing for diesel. And you know what? A year from now, we may be making a pretty good living.
Right.
And all it takes is a few relationships to click.
Yeah.
Both on the client side and the carrier side. So you're never going to stop that from happening. And every year, especially in Chicago, you know, there's a number of new freight broker startups. And I think that'll continue. Some of them will get to a certain size and just kind of stay stagnant at that level, and others will get an infusion of capital and they'll get, you know, better talent and they'll get more sophisticated and they'll grow. I do think, though, that the big get bigger. I think in today's environment, it takes capital and technology to grow. And, you know, there's also a lot of private equity and venture capital money on the sidelines that loves this space. So if you've got a good idea and if you've got, you know, some talent on your team, you'll find plenty of people to invest in it. And so I think the answer to your question is yes, both. You know, there's going to be more new entrants and there's going to be more consolidation. But I do believe that the market will be controlled by the larger that have density and scale and technology and data science.
You know, it's funny. So in addition to DATM up here at MIT, and I run a center up here, and once a month, literally for the last 5 years, someone has come to me, students. They discovered this brokerage market and they created an app and they're ready to go. And they want to know, how does it look? And it's like, oh my God, guys, come on. There's a lot of people here. So there is a lot of interest from the tech side. They see this problem. It reminds me of 99 to 2000. Everyone's going to have a market and you know, boom, lights out and disintermediate the brokers. But that never seems to really happen. They keep proving their worth.
Well, here's the thing. You know, intellectually, you can visualize this, you know, freight matching platform. And, you know, that's actually the easy part. The hard part, I think, is, you know, when I think about Echo growing profitably, you know, for the last 15 years, it's figuring out the nuance in the process. You know, how do you quote a shipment? Who does the quote? You know, what are their parameters? How do you set the maximum buy price? How does Curious Sales become aware of that? How do they source the capacity? You know, how do you pay commissions? How do you incent behavior? Can you use algorithms to nudge behavior? Mm-hmm. So there's so many things to do in the process that is our business that I think the casual observer oversimplifies it.
No, I agree. It's funny because usually I recommend them to talk to someone who has diesel in their veins, you know, find someone out there and talk to someone who's actually driven a truck or worked in this industry, because that usually stops them and they go into something else, right? They find another field. But you brought up a really good point, Doug. Let me pivot to that, the importance of people, because a lot of these guys, I worked in software for a number of years, and you think the algorithm's the hard part. But as you said, that's the easy part because you can control all that. It's working with the people. So I've been reading more about your recruiting efforts and that Echo's won some awards, and I was fascinated by it, especially since you're doing this during a pandemic. So can you describe how your recruiting process has evolved and what your focus is? Because as you said, it seems to be a major focus of what you're doing at Echo that differentiates you.
Well, we believe that people are the core of our business, even though, you know, we talk a lot about the technology. That's sexy. It's what people are interested in. But we also know that it's the people that makes it happen. And the relationships actually come first. So we've always believed in people. You know, if you go back to some research that Harvard did back in the 90s, the service profit chain, I believe that if you want to maximize your profits, you have to start with your employees. And by that, I mean that employees have to be excited about what they do. They have to be happy to come to work, because happy employees do a better job taking care of customers. And if you take care of your customers, they're willing to forgive you when you make a mistake. They're willing to pay a little bit more money, you know, and that those two things will make you profitable. So, you know, that's where we start thinking about our business model is the employees. And we have a pretty robust recruiting program. We've got 9 in-house recruiters plus a tech recruiter. We recruit at on campus at 35 universities, and we post jobs at over 100 universities. And then we think that, you know, we offer young people an opportunity to come into this industry that's 10% of GDP and start to build a career for themselves, whether it's at Echo or somewhere else. You know, they come in, we give them 8 weeks of training. And once they're done with training, they have formal mentorship that continues with them as they progress in their job. And so, you know, that's a big part of what we do. We also think that this last year with COVID tested our recruiting, and we had to move it all to virtual. We used Microsoft Teams, And that's been pretty pivotal in helping us, you know, not miss a beat with interviews and transitioning to remote work. So, yeah, it's been a crazy year, but, you know, we hired over 600 people last year, and, you know, we'll hire a similar amount this year.
Do you find, Doug, that the younger generation, it's easier for them or harder for them to work remotely? Have you found it? Where have you found the resistance? Because everyone had to go remote for the most part, for at least a part of the pandemic. Did you find resistance at the young, the old, or was it the same?
I think it was the same. In our business, everybody uses technology, young and old. I think that the young people are probably a little more adept at, you know, jumping on social media and FaceTiming or whatever they're doing. And so they were probably more at ease with it. But everybody's adjusted just fine. I would say, though, that with our class of interns, for instance, they all wanted to be, you know, in the building with the people and experience our culture because, you know, we think our culture is a big part of who we are and how we perform. And, you know, that takes a hit when everybody's working from home.
Now, let me ask about that because we're struggling with that up here at MIT. Some people have gotten very comfortable working at home and they're kind of okay with it and they might not want to come back. And then there are other people who are chomping at the bit. Are you going to allow people to choose to be remote or not? Or are you doing a mix? How are you handling that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my instinct is to say we're all going to get back to work because I just see the power of having people together, you know. And but the reality is we've proved that we can be productive. We just had our best quarter ever with nearly 100% of our people working from home. And some people like it. You know, if I think about our employees' attitudes, it's kind of on a typical bell curve, right? On one end of the spectrum, you've got people that say, I'm afraid to come to work and I don't want to.
Right.
I won't. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, you say, I can't wait to get back to work. I got to be around people. And in the middle, you've got all kinds of other attitudes that are just like, well, you know, as long as there's not a vaccine or if other people aren't going to work, I'm not going to. Or, you know, I like not having to buy gas and commute for an hour and a half each way. So, you know, I see that the general propensity is not to want to come back until they have to. So we've thought about it and, you know, we're going to come back with a hybrid approach where at some point in time, some people will need to be in. Other people will have the option. And in some cases, there will be parameters. But we think it's going to look a lot more flexible.
Right.
We're tying that return to work program with kind of the vaccine deployment. And as soon as we get to the point, you know, we'll give our employees plenty of notice and they'll understand what the plan is.
I guess a lot of your employees are kind of younger. So they probably don't hit that qualification yet. In different states, they all have different targets. But like here, we're not thinking we'll get it to the student level to the mid-20s until May, probably.
Yeah, I think in our mind, we're not going to be able to do anything until the June, July timeframe, because
that's
how long it's going to take for vaccine distribution to really be prevalent.
Yeah, we're focused on 1 September. Here. And then the other challenge we're concerned with is everyone, you know, hybrid, you work from home because you can do some things better at home than in the office. You can be creative, do something. But we're afraid everyone's going to choose Monday and Friday. And then Wednesday will be the big peak day. And then it's a ghost town on Monday and Friday, you know. So it's how do you balance that and how do you get permission? So it's a challenge that I think every company.
Well, then there's also real estate ramifications, right?
Oh, big time.
If you suddenly take half your people and they're working 2 days a week, you don't need as much space. And in fact, you don't need dedicated space. You can go to a hoteling concept.
Right. But then you have to increase the amount of IT support because now they have two offices.
Yeah.
Right. And right now, everyone's kind of cannibalized and moved their office at home. But now you'll have to duplicate. So it's an interesting trade-off.
Yeah. You also have to potentially buy more laptops as opposed to stationary PCs because they have to be mobile.
And bandwidth at home and all those kind of things. Let me focus in one more thing about recruiting, because trucking, transportation is a predominantly white male industry. But I noticed that you have some very strong diversity and inclusion goals. How have you been able to add those into your recruiting process? And how has that been? How has that evolved?
Well, I would say that, you know, you mentioned earlier that we have a young demographic in our company, and that's actually been instructive to me. You know, that the young people today, the Gen Y and the Gen Z cohorts, care a lot about social issues. They're passionate.
Yes.
And that's caused me to rethink, you know, how I grew up and what my, some of my views were. So I would say, you know, fairly early on at Echo, we started thinking a lot about, you know, how do we get more women into this business? We should, you know, create the pipelines to recruit for it. We talked about diversity, you know, years ago, whether it was, you know, the color of your skin, your gender, your sexual preference, disabilities, doesn't matter. Any group that's potentially disadvantaged, you know, I think we have a pretty thoughtful culture towards, you know, making everybody successful. So today, you know, we, even prior to the George Floyd murder, we were, had employee resource groups. We had, you know, a military group. We have women of logistics group. We've got Echo Pride, you know, you name it. We've got groups. and we give them support. And at the executive level, we give them resources. We encourage our employees to volunteer and get involved in the community. And with the recent spotlight that's been placed on diversity, equity, and inclusion, we've gone some additional lengths to, you know, make sure that we're thinking about, you know, everything clearly. We brought in a consultant that's working with the executive team and helping us assess our own personal views and whether we have unconscious biases. We're doing education in an organization to make sure that all of our people understand the different cultures that exist in our company. We've got a D&I committee comprised of employees that does a lot of work with educating the company and also advising the executive team on things that they think are issues. And then in the recruiting realm, we're working with outside, you know, parties and agencies to find more diverse candidates for our pipelines. Things like historically Black colleges and universities or HBCUs and community colleges. You know, we've always hired four-year degrees, but maybe some of our jobs don't actually require a four-year degree. So we're thinking about it in a lot of different ways, and I think we're making good progress.
Great. Yeah, the challenge that I've always had at different companies is opening the pipeline. Like you said, it's usually not a question of they're not being hired, but they're not in that pipeline. And so getting out there earlier into it seems to be the key.
But we also found that you have to look at retention rates, too, because you might find that certain classifications of employees may not be as successful. And then you have to look in and dig in and find the root causes of why are they not as successful. You know, are there inherent... structural barriers that are holding them back or causing them to churn out of the company.
And do you find that mentorship helps with retention, I assume?
Yeah, mentorship is very important. And one of the things that, frankly, I've been learning about is that, you know, if business was a race, we're not all starting at the same starting line, right? Some people are starting 15 yards behind you, and they may have all the potential, and they may have the right attitude, but they're getting a late start. So, you know, can you identify those people that have potential and get them up to the starting line? They still have to run the race.
That's a good analogy. I'm thinking back to my career. I started off in the military. The word mentor, I don't think was invented then. I don't remember having a mentor as growing up. Did you have, can you point to one in your first, say, 4 or 5 years of your career? Someone who you said, oh my gosh, this is the guy or gal who's going to help me chart my career.
I would say, no, I seem like I had more coworkers in the early part of my career. Later on, I did have some executives that I would consider mentors, but that was probably in the middle of my career.
So let's get back to the industry. And so it's an established industry. It's been around for a while, and there are a lot of things that are being used, like we talked about earlier, that don't make sense anymore. Right. Whether it's LTL classifications. But let me give you a couple of these. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about if they will go away. And so the first one is EDI. Hard to set up. Everyone has their own standard, but it's still dominant. Do you have any sense of the percentage of your volume that goes EDI versus any other communication mode? Is it still dominant for Echo?
Well, I would say it's still dominant just because the shippers and carriers are slow to adopt the new technology and capabilities. You know, we would love to be rid of EDI, but as long as your trading partners use it, you have to use it. APIs are a much more efficient way to transmit information. It's cleaner. The data's better. The integration is actually easier, but you've got to have the capability to do it. And what I find is so many shippers in particular are not able to get resources from IT for their shipping activities. You know, it's just not a priority in the organization. And so they're stuck with legacy technology or outdated systems, and that dictates how they do business. Likewise with carriers. You know, most carriers are on legacy systems that are 20, 30, 40 years old, and you know, they can tweak it around the edges, but they can't build new functionality in those systems. They have to typically bring in third-party systems and bolt them on to try to do some of the more modern things. So I do think that API integration will be the future. I just think the transition to get there is going to take years and years.
You know what the best thing that happened in 2017, 2018 is that a bunch of shippers' transportation budgets got busted. And so suddenly they said, oh, maybe we need to invest. So I've talked to a lot of shippers, and that the best thing that happened to them was this capacity crisis. So they got the senior management attention, whether it was to improve dwell time at their own facilities, improve their systems. I didn't see a widespread move to APIs. I think that's being more driven by the software vendors, to be honest, trying to tie that.
Yeah, but I think that's actually a good way to get adoption, right? Because if I'm a shipper, let's say I'm vice president of supply chain for a company, and I can't get the budget to build technology, you know, I can go hire one of these third party vendors to do it for me, and I have a light integration task to make it work, but I don't have to build all the code.
Yeah, and so this is the next big dominant design that needs to get improved, the shipper TMSs. I built one or two back when I was in software, and I know you started building one with Selectrans, and I imagine some of that got adopted into Echo. But this seems to be, when we talk to our shippers at DAT, our different FMIC customers, that's the number one complaint. If they want to do something innovative, they have to hack their own system, whether it's in the routing guide or something like that. Do you see TMSs evolving? Do you see one or two out there that you think is the way, the direction the industry needs to go?
You know, I'm the wrong person to ask because okay. I'm a build-it-yourself kind of guy. I don't like using other people's software. But I realize that most of the world uses other people's software. So I do think it's going to evolve. I think, you know, in the past, it's, you know, looking up rates and making, you know, some minor optimization decisions. But I think in the future, TMSs will incorporate more AI and machine learning and algorithmic solutions to suggest how you ought to be managing your freight. I mean, hell, my iPhone does it now for me, and I don't even have to program it. So I would assume that TMSs will do that too.
And being cloud-based makes it a lot easier. I remember having to deliver, what was it called? API. And so it was, what was it called? They used to call it putting lipstick on a pig, where we had the mainframe, but it was cloud-based before cloud existed, before software as a service. It was, I forget what it was called, back when I was part of Sabre, who did all the, you know, that remote computing. But it was not sexy for a long time.
Yeah, everybody wanted on-prem data center, right?
Yeah. It's changed. Last thing that's being done that I think needs to change or might need to change is annual RFPs. Shippers have been doing this for 25, 30 years. I cut my teeth on this in the 90s, you know, doing an auction, reverse auction for your shippers, doing it for their carriers. But when we work with shippers, they're just as unhappy with this process. It takes forever. It sucks up resources, and it falls apart in a couple months. So what are your thoughts? Will the RFP go away? Will it get bigger? How will it change? What are your thoughts?
Well, we're already seeing it change some right now. I mean, just in basic terms, shippers are putting out shorter contracts. Yeah. So it used to be a 1 year bid. Now it's their mini bids that are 6 months or a quarter. I do think, you know, one of our competitors has been talking in the media about, you know, what I would classify as a cost plus arrangement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's interesting. You know, we would gladly, and we do have cost plus arrangements with some of our managed transportation customers. And the main requirement there is trust.
Right,
you know,
right.
They have to trust that the cost that we're adding our markup to is a fair market price, right? And they also have to trust that we are incented to buy as well as we can buy on each and every shipment. Because if they think that we're going to go, oh, we get a markup on everything we do, we're just going to get lazy and not be as ferocious of buyers, then they lose, right? So, you know, having an index or some sort of way to benchmark your performance on price, I think is a key ingredient to a cost plus arrangement. But I think it's totally doable. And if I go back to the words we talked about earlier, if we have relationships and we have trust and we have transparency and we can show each other the math, we could get away from this annual RFP system and do something that floats with the market.
Yeah, people have talked about this, and we've done some research up here at MIT, and I was talking with Woody Richardson from Schneider. Everyone wants to do index-based rates until you talk about the details. And so we interviewed a bunch of carriers a year and a half ago for a project that we did for a company, and carriers were all for an index as long as it moved in one direction. It could move up, but it can't move back down. So have you seen index-based pricing work anywhere? I've heard pilots, but it's one of these things that everyone is a really good idea, like an adjustable rate mortgage, right? But I haven't seen the nuts and bolts work.
Yeah.
At any scale.
Well, I think it starts with how do you derive your index, right? And, you know, you guys obviously have an index. You know, we have an internal index that we use.
Sure.
It's driven algorithmically. And, you know, what we found for a while is that it didn't react fast enough to market changes. So we had to tweak the weighting of the time element and so that it could react quicker. And, you know, now it works pretty good. And we've got pretty good confidence in it and allows us to take our hands off the steering wheel. I think it always comes down to, you know, put it in statistical terms, like what's the standard deviation and how big's the sample size in that lane. And if you know that you have a fair market price, but there's some normal distribution around it, you know, pick your place in that normal distribution and let's agree to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. You talk about standard deviation. Think back to when you first came in this industry. When I came into this industry with a PhD, so I was a weird one coming in the early 90s, late 90s. But now I talk to companies. I can't find a trucking company of any size or broker that doesn't have an analytics department, at least some masters and usually a couple PhDs poking around. It's changed. So it didn't used to be that way.
Well, that was your very first question that you asked me. You know, I remember doing some basic statistics in 1981, and my regional manager said, what are you doing here? And it was a regression model. I told him that I could predict our region's operating ratio, you know, 3 weeks before the accounting department told us what it was. And so I used to do that for him every month, and he thought it was magic.
Now, I look at your LinkedIn profile. Weren't you in Alaska for one of your first assignments? Is that why you got sent to Alaska? Because you were using math?
Yeah, I was using math. No, I spent some time with Consolidated Freightways, and they had me managing up in Alaska. So I worked out of Seattle, though, so I went up there twice a month. But it was a nice way to manage Alaska.
That's interesting. Hey, last question, Doug, then I'll let you get on with your rest of your vacation. Pandemic showing signs of easing. Have you been vaccinated yet, or did you have COVID? I had
COVID back in March. I will get vaccinated, but I'm kind of waiting for the people that need it worse than I do to get it. And, you know, I still have antibodies, so I feel pretty impervious at the moment.
Oh, that must feel good. I'm still waiting. We'll see how it goes. But my question is, we've lived under a pandemic and lockdown for a year now. What silver linings, what things did you learn to do now that you think will apply post-pandemic, positive outcomes from the pandemic and the way you've operated? Anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the you alluded to it in your earlier question, the ability to work from home. I mean, I would have never dreamed that we would be operating like this for this long. I mean, this would be like my worst disaster recovery nightmare. And so, you know, in 3 days' notice, we sent everybody home and crossed our fingers that the technology would work and that people had enough bandwidth. And you know, we sent people walking out the door with a monitor in their arms. And here we are a month later. We've hired 600 people. We trained them all remotely. We interviewed them remotely and hired them remotely. They've never been to our office before. So I guess the thing that I've learned is don't get stuck in your paradigms about how you think you have to do business, because there's always new ways and new opportunities, and they might just be better, you know. And I think coming out of this, we'll have some hybrid approach. I think the whole business community in general is going to have a hybrid approach. I think there'll be less travel. There's going to be more, you know, Zoom meetings or what have you. And we'll find the right level of productivity and the right level of human interaction to go together.
Yeah, it's kind of a leap of faith. For some people, you're going to let them be. They're not going to be right there being able to be watched. So it'll be interesting to see how it evolves out. Well, yeah. Doug, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris.
All right. So everyone stay tuned for the Truckload Market Update with Dr. Enam Eyoub. Let's take a brief pause to talk about the FMIC Pulse Signal Report from DAT. Formerly part of Chainalytics, the Freight Market Intelligence Consortium, or FMIC, is now part of DAT Freight and Analytics. FMIC Pulse members receive monthly reports based on their subscription, which includes DAT IQ's proprietary forecasting approach to predicting the future of North American truckload markets. Are rates dropping? Is the market getting tighter? How should I approach next year's transportation budget? All of these questions and more are answered in the FMIC Pulse Signal report. Visit DAT.com/pulse signal and fill out the form for a free limited view of the report. And become a member of FMIC to receive unlimited access. All right, let's get back to it.
Welcome to the Over-the-Road Truckload Market Update for April 8, 2021. In today's market update, we will discuss the market changes in the last 2 weeks. Let's start with dry van. Active rates are up 1%, spot rates down 4%, replacement rate is positive 6%. This means the new contract rates are about 6% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are flat, spot rates are flat, and replacement rates are positive 5%. Finally, on the intermodal side, active rates are flat, spot rates are flat, and replacement rate is positive 3%.
So, Enam, this is a surprising. So, it seems like the surge peak that we saw in spot rates in February was just a isolated event. Do you think with the overall market conditions are coming over, we're seeing a slight decline or cooling off of the market? What do you think?
Yeah, we see the spot rates cooling off, but the impact it had on the contract rates or the active rates is still holding. So we are seeing the active rates going back up, especially in the dry van.
Yeah, and I guess corresponding, I mean, down in Texas where you are and up here in New England, it's slightly different, but across the United States, the markets are seeming to open up. Immunization is increasing 3 million a day, I heard now. So lockdowns are starting to loosen. And then you have the stimulus money coming in. How do you think the surge in consumer demand, consumer sales will impact the trucking market? What are your thoughts?
I think so. I think my take on it as of what we are seeing today is that this contract rates, it seemed to be, you know, it'll hold. We won't see a relief until maybe the Q3, the way it is looking, because we typically see a spot rate spike in June. So we are, you know, currently in April, May, June. So I think we are not going to see that much of a depression in the active rates until the Q3 as we see now.
So the typical decline we see in early spring got kind of pushed because of the spikes and everything. And we're going to run to that June typical seasonal increase. Interesting. What about the supply side? There's a lot of talk about, you know, construction market heating up. Sales of homes is way up. The shifting of drivers. to construction instead of getting behind a wheel. What do you think? Is that myth or is that reality?
I think on the truck side, I think all those new trucks that were ordered will start flowing in Q2, Q3 time period. So I think from an availability of equipment perspective, maybe we'll get some relief. And I was taught back in the day that, you know, the construction to driver, you know, driving truck shift is, you know, significant. But I'm yet, you know, at least nowadays I'm seeing, you know, that shift may not be that real, or, you know, but we will have, what I'm trying to say is we'll have drivers when we need them.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freight Find. The Freight Find podcast is hosted by Dr. Enam Ayoub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at dat.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freight Find wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freight Find or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@dat.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freight Find, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.